hardball hitting with a baseball bat. Kick up your heels, kid, and leave them all flat. What does it mean to be American?
This is Democracy Optimist. Here's your host, Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law.
Lots of people have asked me why we use the Electoral College to elect the president. It might seem arcane in today's world. Others say it's unfair and that we should use a national popular vote, especially after the candidate with the most votes nationwide did not win the presidency in both 2000 and 2016. Here to explain the history of the Electoral College is Carolyn DuPont, a professor of history at Eastern Kentucky University. She's the author of a new book titled Distorting Democracy, The Forgotten History of the Electoral College and Why It Matters Today. Carolyn, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first, what prompted you to write this book on the history of the Electoral College, which, by the way, is an excellent read, and I encourage everyone who is interested in the Electoral College to take a look. But what prompted you to write this book?
Yeah, that's a great question, because it actually has nothing to do with my usual areas of interest. I'm a historian of American religion and African Americans. And but I was always interested in the Electoral College, just as kind of an idiosyncrasy, I thought, in our system. And I got in a conversation with two friends who were defending the Electoral College, and I was saying, well, you know, it wasn't established for that reason, it was for this reason. And I was trying to make a case, but the more I talked, the more I realized I didn't have the goods to back up what I was saying, and I wanted to have them. And so I just got curious and started doing research. And the next thing I knew, I was writing about a time period and a topic that I never really delved into deeply.
Sometimes that's how research goes, right? We just find a topic that's interesting and you start down the rabbit hole, and
there you are.
Several years later,
yeah.
You have a book.
It's great fun.
Take us back to those hot, sticky days in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787 at the Constitutional Convention. Who were the people who attended?
Yes. So let me just say it's over 4 months that they convene to write. Really, they think they're there to fix the Articles of Confederation.
And actually, take us back to that. What were the problems with the Articles of Confederation that they were trying to fix?
Yeah, they were many. I would say the greatest problem was inability to tax. The federal government or the national government had no authority to tax. And the states had that authority, and they were supposed to pass a little bit along to the national government, but they often didn't do that, and there was no means to coerce them. And this created problems. You know, they weren't able to pay soldiers who had fought in the Revolutionary War. They weren't able to do anything about the debt that we had incurred as a result of the Revolutionary War. And so the country was in dire financial straits, and this was creating civil unrest. And the question becomes particularly relevant because when they convened to try to do something about the government, there was a lot of fear. There was this concern that if we don't get this right, if we don't succeed and come out of this convention with a real plan, our country may splinter, we may have civil war, we may be taken over by a foreign government. And this concern comes up over and over and over again as those 55 delegates are meeting. And whenever there's a stalemate, they raise this specter of failure and what it could mean.
And, you know, most people think that the founders had this grand idea of how they wanted the government to work, this new structure, how they wanted to elect the president. Your book challenges that common perception among the public to suggest that really everything here, especially with respect to the Electoral College, was a compromise. Tell us a little bit about those competing considerations and what that compromise was.
Yes, and I would even go so far as to say that a lot of the delegates took defeat. you know, there's this idea compromise means that everybody gets something and you all agree to it. often they just took defeats and said, well, I'm not going to get this. I think it's better, but we're just going to go on under the circumstances. And so, you know, they have many different ideas about what the government should look like. And some of them changed their minds about certain things over time. But with respect to the president, you know, they didn't even agree at the outset on whether we needed one or three presidents. And with respect to how the president should be chosen, they floated essentially three different ideas. One, an electoral college that could be structured a number of ways. But they rejected an electoral college plan a total of five times. So it's not as if, gee, this is the best way to do it, and we all know this. But the plan that really seemed to have the most support was that Congress would choose the president. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of mystifying when you're reading the record of their debates. They all agree that that's a problematic method, and I think anyone can see that if Congress is electing the president, there's no separation of powers there, and that the president then becomes very open to manipulation by Congress. They all agreed that this was highly problematic. And, you know, speech after speech, we can't do it this way. This is opens us up for corruption and intrigue and foreign intervention. But then they go back and vote for it. And it's, you know, you start to scratch your head. And I will say, just to underscore, that this was the real method that they seemed to settle on, even when they wrote a draft constitution about two-thirds of the way through the convention. That was the plan, that Congress was going to choose the president. And the notion of popular election, there were some real champions of popular election, people who gave very compelling speeches in that regard, but it simply couldn't get enough traction. And what's really holding that up, what's really preventing the delegates from agreeing to that, is that the slave states understood that they would not be as well represented as they were in Congress because mm-hmm. of the three-fifths compromise. They got a little bump. And then the small states also understood that congressional election was better for them. And so in the last a little more than 2 weeks, 17 days of the convention, they finally just punted it to a committee. And the committee designed the Electoral College that is written in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. And the goal here wasn't necessarily to give the smaller states a greater say, right? That's kind of the common perception, yeah. Yeah. I think, is that, oh, well, you know, we're making sure that the small states have a larger say in who elects the president. But that wasn't really the goal, right?
No, the goal was to get something that they could all sign off on and go home. That was the goal. And, you know, it was no one's first choice. The Electoral College was no one's first choice, but it was an acceptable second choice. Mm-hmm. And you can really see in these last few weeks of the convention that they're working very quickly, and they've been there since the middle of May. It's now early September, and they really want to go home.
And did that surprise you, what you found? I mean, did you have an idea of you know, this idea that we all kind of understand the Electoral College today is trying to protect the small states from having a say, or that the framers had this grand idea? Did what you found in your research surprise you?
It surprised me, and I think I had hoped and thought that there was a principled commitment behind it, that there's some high-minded philosophical principle that they thought the Electoral College filled. And the truth is, you just don't find anywhere in the sources where any of them talk about it that way. Mm-hmm. There's not a commitment, a philosophical principle behind it. And in fact, James Madison said, we adopted, and I won't get the quote exactly right, but something to the effect of, we adopted the mode that was most expedient until a better one could be found, until experience should show a better one. So it didn't feel like, oh, this is something that really fulfills our values.
Well, let's talk about how the Electoral College has changed or evolved over the years. You know, your book explains that the Electoral College of today is not the same thing of the Electoral College in the framers' time. So tell us a little bit about how the Electoral College has changed throughout the history of this country.
Yes, and I think this is one of the most important arguments that I'm making in the book, because sometimes people feel this sort of sense of, well, if the framers adopted it, it must be best. And, you know, I want to be a good American who believes in the vision of the framers. But if anyone who's defending today's Electoral College is not defending what the framers created. They created a system of proxy election. And the idea was that people who were wise and discerning and knowledgeable about potential candidates would all convene in their states and choose the president. So it was a true choice that the electors were making. And by the way, elector just means voter. So these were the voters. And you can tell by the way they structured the Electoral College, you can read it for yourself in Article 2 of the Constitution, that they were really concerned with corruption. And so they have these corruption-retarding devices built into it. So, for example, the electors must vote by ballot. It has to be a secret vote. No one can put pressure on them. They are bodies. It's really electoral colleges. There's one in each state. They are bodies that meet for this single purpose, and then that's it. They don't have any other function. And the fact that they do meet separately in the state, so they can't get all together and conspire. And so it was the idea that they would make this decision in a hermetically sealed environment, and so it would be a good, wise choice. Well, that vision just evaporated very, very quickly. And as early as 1796, we see electors being tampered with. And in fact, I have to say it's some of the framers of the Constitution who were doing the tampering. Alexander Hamilton, I like to call him the tamperer in chief. Oliver Ellsworth, who was from Connecticut and later became a chief justice of the Supreme Court. James Wilson, you know, they're trying to get their man in. And so they're talking to the electors and say, vote for this person. And so that's one of the things is the tampering with electors. But then there's the pledging of electors in advance. So in that case, electors aren't showing up to exercise discernment and judgment. They've already promised their discernment and judgment to a specific candidate. But perhaps the most significant change is the adoption of winner-take-all, which at the time they called it the general ticket. And I just want to underscore for listeners that winner-take-all, which is the system that 48 states use today, where the winner of the popular vote gets all the electors in that state, that was not the framers' vision. It is not written into the Constitution. But it became clear that if you adopted that system, you could deprive the minority party within the state of any representation at all in the Electoral College. And so over time, states shifted toward that system. And by the 1830s, all but South Carolina are using that system. In South Carolina, the legislature selects the electors until after the Civil War. So that really converts the Electoral College from a proxy election by wise and discerning people into essentially an algorithm. And the final change I would note is the short ballot, which is adopted in the 20th century. It was put out there as a method to prevent error because when you showed up to vote, you got a ballot with electors on it. Sometimes the candidate would be named at the top, but sometimes it would just be a whole bunch of electors. And, you know, if you live in a large state that has 40 or 50 electors, you've got to check every ballot. And sometimes people made errors. And so now we vote for a candidate, but those votes are transferred to their electors, and electors no longer serve any purpose. So I think you can see that this system is really, it's an algorithm that distorts our votes.
Yeah, and even today, as you said, 48 states use the winner-take-all Maine and Nebraska split the Electoral College votes based on congressional district. So the last part of your book rejects the Electoral College.
Yes, it does.
You make an argument for today's modern democracy to move towards a popular vote winner. So tell us the basic argument.
Well, the basic argument is that today, as it stands right now, under the Electoral College system that we're using, our votes are not equal. And I'll just, as a way of underscoring this, tell listeners that 6 million people in California voted for Donald Trump, and they got no electors. And so, you know, that happens in every state. Whoever votes for the candidate who loses in that state gets no electors. And that candidate might lose by a fraction of a percent, but they still get no representation in the Electoral College. And in addition to that, there's this feature where each of us who votes and votes for electors, we're voting for a different number of electors. Here in Kentucky, we vote for 8 electors. But in Texas this year, they're going to vote for 40 electors. Mm-hmm. And so our votes are just simply unequal at the ballot box in a way that we would never tolerate in any other election. And I think all of us value political equality as fundamental, that we're all the same when we approach the ballot box. And I think that's just a very simple value that most Americans can embrace.
But what about the argument that a national popular vote plan would really favor the cities and the East and West Coast? Some people say it's a push to elect Democrats more easily because, you know, Democrats tend to win in the coasts. And, you know, so if you're looking for a popularity contest nationwide, this is either a partisan push or, you know, states like Kentucky won't matter or states like Iowa won't matter because you don't need the votes from the middle of the country.
Voters will matter. So let me just tell you why that argument does not work. It's the logic of the Electoral College. It's built on the logic of the Electoral College, which is that the people in the state all vote the same way. And if you look at a real map that shows how people vote, you will see that most of the United States is purple. Mm-hmm. And there are bluer pockets and redder pockets. But let's just take the most populous city in the country, which is New York City. It is not all blue. Staten Island, for example, was red in 2020. Let's take Los Angeles. That's the city that most people hold up. Well, 25% of people in Los Angeles voted for Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. So the cities do not all vote the same. Now, the truth is, for the most part, in the larger cities, it is true that more people vote for Democrats. But you only have to go down to the fourth largest city, Houston, Texas, and you see that there's really just a few percentage points separating the Republican from the Democrat in the 2020 election. Moreover, there are not enough people, even if they were all voting the same, in the cities to control the vote of their state, much less the vote of the entire country. And then the other thing I'll say about that is with respect to the states and the idea that the large states would dominate the election. With the Electoral College, in 2024, you would actually be able to win with 12 large states. Mm-hmm. And you cannot do that under a national popular vote. And just as a reminder, you know, I said it a minute ago, but I think it bears repeating, most people are shocked to learn that Donald Trump got more votes out of California than he got out of any other state, popular votes, that is. Joe Biden, after California, he got the most popular votes out of Texas. Mm-hmm. And so we identify states as red or blue, but they're not. They're diverse. And I'll just give another great example. We think of the, you know, solidly red South, and you can look at places like Mississippi and Alabama where there are hefty chunks of blue voters that get deprived of any voice.
You know, and something I like to point out to people about the idea that, you know, the cities might control it is, you know, you would be really not a smart candidate if you didn't go to Louisville, Kentucky,
yes,
with the number of voters who are there. And, you know, Louisville's not the largest city in the country. And so mathematically, I think, you know, yeah, maybe you wouldn't go to the very rural areas in some states, but plenty of states have decent sized cities that would make a difference. So let me ask you the question that I ask all of the guests on Democracy Optimist, but I think it is most poignant to ask you, a scholar of the Electoral College. Why should people vote? What's the point, especially given the Electoral College, and that it feels like if you don't live in a swing state, your vote might not matter?
Well, first off, I will say that I'm glad that people realize that, because that's the fundamental problem. And I want people to realize that they have almost no chance of affecting the election if they're not voting with the majority in their state, because I want people to keep this issue out front and center. But I think there are just tons of great reasons to vote. Number one, it's something that we I think this is a fundamental American value. I think the habit of being politically engaged and showing up to cast your vote in election after election is really important. And I think as we look to the future and hopefully change this system that we are modeling for our children, what it means to be civically engaged. I remember the first time I voted, I actually already had children the first time I voted, and I took them into the voting booth with me, and I did it all their growing up years because I wanted to set an example for them.
Carolyn DuPont is the author of Distorting Democracy, The Forgotten History of the Electoral College, and Why It Matters Today. Carolyn, thanks for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thanks for having me.
Josh, what's in the way of fully abolishing the Electoral College and moving to electing the president strictly by popular vote?
Well, the U.S. Constitution, of course, where it sets out how to determine the electors and that the states can decide, you know, how to appoint their electors. So a constitutional amendment would be in the cleanest path to abolishing the Electoral College. But that's really hard to do. It requires the agreement of two-thirds of each House of Congress and three-quarters of the states, which is a tall task. That's probably why we only have 27 total constitutional amendments and none since 1992. But calls to abolish the Electoral College have increased recently, especially after the candidate who received the most votes nationwide did not win the Electoral College in both 2016 and 2000. And it almost happened in 2004, but in the reverse. If Ohio, which was close, had gone to Democratic candidate John Kerry, then he likely would have won the Electoral College, while incumbent George W. Bush would have received the most votes nationwide. It also occurred in 1876 and 1888. Because of the Electoral College, candidates focus on the swing states. In the 2020 presidential election, 96% of general election campaign events were concentrated in just 12 states, where the candidates were polling within an 8-point margin of each other. Well, one of the most prominent potential solutions is the, quote, agreement among the states to elect the president by national popular vote, which is better known as the National Popular Vote Plan. It's been adopted by 17 states and the District of Columbia, though mostly they are in so-called blue states. Under the plan, each state would award their electoral votes to whichever presidential ticket wins the popular vote nationwide, regardless of the statewide vote. The compact will take effect once the number of electoral votes in all of the states that are participating surpasses 270, which is enough to win the election. Currently, the compact has been enacted by enough jurisdictions to account for 209 total electoral votes. There are, however, potential constitutional problems with the National Popular Vote Plan, including that it is an end run around the Constitution. In addition, the Constitution prohibits compacts between states without congressional approval, and this is called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. So if it ever passes enough states to go into effect, you can bet there will be litigation and the issues will be hotly contested.
Let's say a listener is really, really interested in this question. They want to dig deeper. Is there a good online resource to go to for this issue?
Yeah, listeners should check out nationalpopularvote.com. That's the website that is the leading source for information about the National Popular Vote Plan. It has tons of resources and research about the issue, as well as a list of which states have adopted the plan so far.
What does it mean? To be American?
Thanks for joining us for this series of conversations about how elections work, about the value of your vote, and about challenges to your right and freedom to make choices at your local polling place. Find our series online at democracyoptimist.com. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm Tom Martin, your series producer. Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Mason Graber and Stephen Dabney, research assistants. Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Democracy Optimist is a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions for Richmond, Kentucky-based public radio station WEKU.